You're listening to The Blind Chick, an AfterSight original podcast. We're telling you stories about strength, overcoming hurdles, and living experiences. We see who you really are. Blindness can be an adventure. Are you ready for the journey of a lifetime? We are.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Blind Chick. That's Moses Street.
And that's Penn Street, The Blind Chick. And I'm so excited because for the very first time, Penn and I are broadcasting in the same room together on the same microphone. And we're in this ratty little cabin in the middle of nowhere in the Rocky Mountains. And there's eight really creepy people outside our cabin watching us for the last 24 hours. So happy Halloween coming up.
Not really. We're sitting actually.
I'm in the cabin.
You're in the cabin. I'm in a really nice hotel in Alamosa, Colorado. I don't know where he is. Oh my goodness. Well, today's show, we have been waiting so long for this. Our guest had technical difficulties last time. We had technical difficulties this time, but we are connecting. Today we have the amazing Daya Muhammad, and I hope I didn't butcher your name. But Daya was, she's a blind filmmaker, she's an author, policy expert, and disability advocate whose story really spans from Capitol Hill all the way to Hollywood, which both of those topics are dear to our hearts. She served as the director of disability policy at the White House during the President Obama, and she also has worked on groundbreaking initiatives in healthcare, which is absolutely amazing, and education, which I cannot wait to dive into that, and also tech ethics, which is so very, very important to our community. As a filmmaker, Day created and produced the PBS documentary series Renegades, celebrating really badass, I like that, badass disabled change makers, and was even a producer on Unseen, a very powerful film following the journey of an undocumented blind immigrant. Which I cannot wait to get my hands on. It's amazing. She's also the author of The Labyrinth Archivist. My eyeballs are playing tricks on me.
I think it's Archivist.
Okay. Poor Day. Which is a fantasy novella, and it's featuring a blind heroine of color. And also, this is exciting, which I can't wait to talk about, is She Fences. Yep. Yeah, basically Day is just, you know, she's just a real life superhero. I'm sure she has her cape on right now. She has a guide dogs, and that guide dog I heard actually threw up in the White House. I have my own barfing guide dog story to go along with that. So, Day, we are so, so excited to have you here on The Blind Chick.
We are so thrilled. I know. So thrilled.
I know. And there is so much more about you, but it would take up the entire show just going through all of your accolades and accomplishments. But
we're just going to do enough podcasts to cover you for the next year.
Yeah, exactly. Day, welcome to really The Blind boring. Chick.
Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely.
I'm super excited. Y'all made me sound real fancy up there.
That's what we're here for. That's all we're here for. So
I know. So we're well, because it's usually the beginning, because, you know, I'm sighted, but being around Penn all the time. The first thing everybody that she ever meets has to ask her, they cannot not do it, is how did you lose your sight? And yours was dramatic. It had to do with rock climbing?
I was in college at the time, and it was a rock climbing accident. So that's kind of where that was. I have to admit, you're right. It is kind of the first thing anybody asks anyone pretty much with any disability. It's kind of a weird thing. And I'm like, dude, it's like, why do people do that?
I don't know. It always is amazing to me because you're standing there before them, right? And like, I feel like, is there a sighted person question that blind people ask about sighted people?
Well, I know being an old hippie, the one question I always get, your mother abandoned you, didn't she?
Wow. I'm going to have to remember that one. Come up
with a ridiculous answer, though, and I never could quite find one like really good enough because I'm like, you're going to ask me that? I'm going to answer with something. And I'm like, I don't have it. I the best I ever did once was when someone's like, "Oh, you dress real nice. Who dresses you in the morning?" Yeah, my answer: whoever stayed the night before.
A little Mae West going on there.
I used to say, but I don't now. But I used to say drugs. It was drugs.
She did.
Yeah, that. I'm not sure I can get away with that one.
Yeah, she did that to a bunch of teenagers once, and they all just shocked. This would be
needs to host a contest. That's it.
You have to be shocked.
Well, and this is a question that is always with me: is I'm a real wimpy person. And it wasn't blindness when I went through my big shock of life. It took me about 10 years to get through the trauma drama and all the heartache and all that kind of crap. So it's always curious to me, is there's no debate that going blind is a trauma. How did you work through yours? How did it hit? How long did it last?
I think it's one of those things where for different people, it's, like you said, it's going to be different answers, but it's also going to be different areas of your life.
I agree with
like
that.
I am somebody who always revels in getting stuff done. And I also have had amazing friends who are really great about, let's go out and do whatever random thing occurred to them. We're going to go to a concert in St. Louis.
Right.
Hop in the car. We're going to drive 2 hours. We're going to have a great time. And the idea was to get out and doing stuff. So for me, that element was, in some ways, getting back to life was very quick. And I had a lot of supportive folks. So it was easy to kind of throw myself into life. And now looking back, we can go, oh, were you avoiding the emotional trauma? Probably. Yeah, it's a very real thing. But in many ways, 6 months or so, and I was, run back in college classes and doing things, with other college students in many ways. And like I said, having a really good supportive network does make a difference, especially when it's a network that didn't know what to do, so basically said, "We will proceed as usual."
Yes,
and we kind of did that, and
we
kind of found our way through. And that actually, in some ways, has worked really best. And I know we'll talk about it later on, but that's also how I found my way into filmmaking and directing film. I ended up walking into a film class, going, "I have no idea how I'm going to do it. I'm a blind person. I want to direct a film," and the instructor's like, "I have no idea how a blind person's going to direct a film, but you know what? We will figure it out."
Exactly.
It was an 8-week like introduction to filmmaking course. And over the 8 weeks, we did figure it out.
Exactly. I do have to ask, because I used to rock climb and actually taught blind students how to rock climb. Did you go back to rock climbing after the accident?
I'll be honest. I have not.
You haven't.
I have not. I'm still a little bit of a chicken. I will say I have been up on a wall a couple of times since then, but it's not hobby wise. It's not something I went back to.
Oh, okay. So yeah. We have, yeah. It's a dangerous sport.
It is. About a week after I had mine, the guy down the hall from me fell. He broke his back. So it was not the safest areas. And our poor residential advisor, I'm sure she wanted to quit after that week. It was two of us. And then, you know, in the space of a, of, you know, 10 days. So
did it change the, because I know you were in college when the accident happened. Did it change your trajectory of your career? Or did you just, like you said, you just, let's figure it out?
A lot of it was, let's figure it out. That didn't change my career at that point. I think there were later changes.
Yeah.
That kind of came from that. But at the time, no. I was working on a social work degree, which I still wanted to do at the time. My biggest issue was the rules and regulations and policies around how you work with children and families is so convoluted, archaic, and burdensome that it's really hard to kind of be effective. And God bless those folks out there who are working and doing it. And so I was so mad about it. I'm like, nope, you know what? I want to be somebody who makes the rules. That way they won't be so terrible. And so for me, that part of it is kind of what made that shift towards law school afterwards, rather than going on for a master's, because I'm like, nope, I will end up breaking the rules and getting fired or going to jail. And I'd rather not do either of those things. So if anything, the biggest difference would be I definitely would be a little more intense and a little more focused insofar as there's that usual, if you're going to do something, there are plenty of naysayers out there. You can't have that doubt in your own head at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's almost like you didn't really rebuild it, your life. You just kind of rewrote it, right? Like you just changed some of those chapters up on where you were headed. But how did you get into fencing? Because I had a wonderful experience of I had the opportunity to take a fencing class that was specifically for blind and low vision, and I loved it. And so when I heard that you really kind of dove into that, how did you end up in a fencing class?
Remember what I said about lovely friends who are supportive.
Yeah,
and also that, you know, why not do anything else? And maybe you talked about rewriting chapters. So maybe it's more I rewrote it in like a bold 20-point font. And the idea being, part of that was I was with someone and we were at the gym and there were folks fencing at the other end. And it was a conversation about recognizing limits and they use that as an example. There are folks on the other side there and they're fencing. And there are things that it is going to become more difficult for blind people to do. And I took that as a personal challenge. Actually, I was downright offended at the time, right? In bold and 20-point font. And so that next week I showed up at the fencing club going, I want to figure out how to do this. And again, I had lovely friends who were like, okay, we'll figure out how to do this.
Oh, that's awesome.
and we did. And I'd love to say it was something fancy. There was a lot of guesswork. There's a lot of bigger than traditional parries. There's a lot of ugly looking movement. but I was young, athletic, you know, and fast. And you know what? That will compensate for a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, I actually did pretty well at it. And would compete with the university. We competed against other universities at the club level. So that I've continued to do probably until the last few years or so. With just too many other things going on, it was too difficult to keep up.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of normal, especially when you're young, you try out different things. And then once you kind of feel like you've accomplished it in a certain way or a certain level, you do move on, right? Like you find the next thing.
Yeah. Yes. And the thing that I'm getting from listening is that that's kind of the creed of an actual artist. is, and it seems to be a theme that's happening through all our podcasts, is that where blindness didn't stop people from having a rich and exciting life, is that was their attitude. And hopefully everybody out listening to this takes this to heart, is that let's figure it out, because you figure behind every invention. It was somebody, well, let's figure it out,
yeah.
You know, how do we plow a bigger field? How do we build a higher building? Let's figure it out. And that seems to be one of the gifts that blind people have.
Yeah. And I know, I have a pretty large family and friend group that's blind and low vision, and it actually spans the globe. But all of us, advocacy always comes up, regardless if it's self-advocacy or advocacy on a bigger level in your community, or maybe there's a law, or, you know, it can be as small as, you know, as you want it to be, or as big as you want it to be. You know, I've been a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. before, and all the way down to, you know, making sure that the cracks on the sidewalk in my neighborhood get fixed. So how did you get into advocacy? And I know people with disabilities, it kind of just comes with the territory, right? Unless you just want to sit on your couch and bury your head in the sand, which is no fun whatsoever. But we all kind of automatically become advocates. But how did you go from, you know, being a student and to really becoming an advocate all the way up to the White House?
Oof, it's a lot. And again, it's one of those things of having good models and good influences. And it sounds like such an odd thing to say, and you'll hear me repeat it a lot, but it makes a difference, like who you spend time with. And I think that's also important, because you have the people who cheerlead for you, and also who eventually, hopefully, you cheerlead for as well. And so I have a couple of folks that I will blame for that one. that is right. Any kind of disability, what you don't really have a choice in advocating, because there's so many barriers, there's so many obstacles that are societally built, and you have either you just acquiesce to them, which means you live a much smaller life, right?
Absolutely.
Or you end up saying, "Hey, that's not right," and it can be as simple as you know, someone says, don't bring your guide dog in here, and you say, "Hey, that's not right."
Right.
And more often than not, people will back down. But how many times, if you just acquiesced, would your life be smaller? And so it kind of, you're right, it comes with the territory. And so that it was always going to be a part of it. Where it got bigger was, I'll give two examples on this. The first was law school's expensive.
Yes.
I was very fortunate to get a graduate student assistantship with a law professor there. And it was Professor Sylvia Lazos. And she was working on issues related to the Latino community in Missouri at the time.
Okay.
And one of the things she was talking about was like, hey, there's been this huge influx of immigrants to the Midwest. And what does that mean? And it was talking about the change in the demographics of the area. And so one of the things that had just come out was legislation talking about police stops and sensing a disparity in there. And one of the great things was, most of the time when you have a graduate assistant, I think professors say, do this, do that. And you end up doing some, like, a lot of the ticky-tacky grunt work. But one of the things she was really good at was giving me the freedom to research and poke around. And so I ended up looking at things like, oh, so here's the census numbers and the counties that have the biggest immigration into it. Oh, let me cross-reference that with where the police stops were that seemed disproportionate. Okay, let me cross-reference that with what counties had the largest agricultural sort of companies, like the ConAgras, the Tyson chicken plants, things like that. And it ended up becoming a map that showed how these things all overlapped. Wow. And let me experiment with that. And then from there, I'm like, you know, it wouldn't be hard to create a know your rights sort of a document and just even a brochure. And we started building that. And it actually was eventually something that was picked up by the Missouri Attorney General's office and something that they had as downloadable on their page to support that community. And I was like, it was kind of falling into a slightly different advocacy because there was the freedom to experiment and explore.
Right.
And while I was doing that and sort of finishing up, there was a representative in the Missouri House, and his name was Representative Bill Boucher out of Kansas City. And he was a retired like electrical engineer, and his wife was a school nurse. And he's one of those folks who, nowadays it almost seems corny to say it, but actually wanted to get into the politics because he wanted to make a difference in his community. And so a lot of his bills were about welfare support and education. He even had some stuff on gun control in there. And he had one about disability employment. And we had and from a conversation with him later, he's like, I thought it would be smart to put my money where my mouth is. And if I'm going to talk about disability employment, I should get a disabled intern for my congressional office in Missouri. And I ended up being that intern.
Wow.
Wow.
And it was great. I didn't know anything about policy or politics, and he didn't know anything about blindness. So he's like, can you answer the phone? Yes, I can answer the phone. Yes. So, and it was a lot of things. And, you know, by the end of my time, it's like, I'm writing draft language for him for legislation. And so it became kind of this exchange of information and knowledge. And kind of from there, from there, you could see me starting to go, I like this sort of policy work. I like this idea of it is literally writing the rules.
Yes.
All the way back to us talking about social work. And so I wanted to go on from there. And what was lovely was from there, I was able to get an internship in Washington in Senator Ron Wyden's office out of Oregon. And part of it's because Boucher wrote me a letter of recommendation and got the governor of Missouri to do one for me as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's how it works, right? Like, you know, it's who you know, and then you just build on that.
Exactly.
That would have been exciting times.
Yeah.
It was very exciting. It's also where you're young and you don't realize how much you don't know. So you are like, we're going to go in, we're going to change everything, and it's going to be amazing.
Yep.
Yeah. But you were really on your own. I mean, as far as the only blind, low vision person, right? Like, it's not like you brought your community with you. How did that feel? I mean, it had to have been a lot of pressure on your shoulders to be the one that was the leader in that area.
I guess I don't think I ever thought of it that way. And there are definitely folks. I'm going to blank on her name now. She worked, I want to say, in the House. Maura, I can't think of her last name. She had like the first guide dog on the Congress floor because they had to pass language to allow it.
What?
Yes. I hate that I can't remember her name now at this moment.
Well, wait. Yeah. I have to back up here a second. Like, you weren't allowed to take a guide dog onto the House floor until you...
At the time, it was exempt from the ADA. And
how?
The woman, it didn't bother me at the time. Because they have exemptions for a lot of things for themselves. And I can't remember her name. And she was an economic advisor for, and I can't remember the Congress member's name.
Mm. That's amazing to me. I mean, it still shocks me with what's going on. I would like to talk a little bit about the ADA. Like you said, it was
Moira Shea. That was it. Moira Shea. It was the Senate floor.
That's right. Yes.
So, and her guide dog Bo, it was going to bother me.
That's okay. I do that too. And you wake up at 2 a.m. Ah, that's But you were really part of some big change with policy when you were in the White House. And like, I know right now, I got a ton of emails from friends all over the United States last week about the concern that Braille is being taken off the education curriculum. And that stuff like that just scares me. And I know that happened years ago, which was one of the reasons I became a lobbyist to make sure that Braille did stay part of the curriculum. And my take on that is that, well, if blind kids don't need to learn Braille, well, then sighted kids don't need to learn how to read either. But also I feel like a lot of the ADA laws is kind of under attack right now. Do you have any inside scoop on kind of what's going on nationally? That is there a movement on making sure that the ADA does stay in place that you know of?
I think the hard part right now is most of the stuff's being chewed away at the sides,
yeah,
rather than directly at the ADA, right? Because the ADA statute, the statute says thou shalt not discriminate.
Right.
Where it gets sticky is in the regulations that determine, like, well, what is that discrimination, right? It says thou shalt not discriminate, but it's like the Department of Justice law regulations that give you the details. I'm just going to use guide dogs again, that allow guide dogs into places. Like, that is the more detail language. And those usually are created not at the congressional level, but they're created by the federal agencies, which are under the executive branch, under the president. And so the easiest thing to do is to start chewing away at those regulations. And that's where we're starting to see the damage
being done. So what can we do about it, Day? Like, how can we, we have a very strong listenership here on the Blind Chick. What can we do about it besides, sending in those template emails?
Right. So here's where this is where I'm going to definitely be stepping into opinion here, if that makes any sense. So we are definitely in some ways in an unprecedented time.
Yeah.
We have an executive branch in some ways that has kind of slowly taken over both the congressional and is impacting the judicial branch. So they're like, we are going to make the rules for everything. That makes it much more difficult because we have to learn how to advocate in a different way. For the last, 50, 100 plus years, we've always done like, we will go to the federal government. Almost all of our disability laws were made at the federal level, which means they're the ones who are controlling how it happens and how to break it.
Right.
So we can go ahead and like argue and push back on some of that. And it'll become a fight then between that and getting the courts to say it's wrong. That can take years. So my personal thought would be there's no reason you can't make state laws that can do some of these things. Right. The idea is the federal law trumps if the federal is stricter.
Right.
But if the state law is something that is stricter then, right? They'd say, we only have to meet this for the federal law. But I'm like, yeah, but your state has said they want something higher level. Then that can be used to support access as well. So, and don't forget, educational curricula in many ways are in like your schools and school boards. Those are controlled at the state level.
Right, right.
Okay, so that makes sense because that's obviously going on in Colorado. They're working overtime to protect some of our rights.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That does make sense. Yeah.
Right. So in some ways, I would recommend looking at also doing some strong advocacy to pass things at the state level where you can.
Yeah.
It doesn't fix everything,
right?
But it is a way to at least continue to provide some of that same previous level. And I'm not saying don't give up at the federal,
right?
But I'm saying it is very difficult to do that, and it is important that we start looking at other ways to address things. And we're starting to see that in other places as well. I know the news recently talked about how the East Coast, was it California and Washington and Oregon, created like a multi-state compact for healthcare.
Right. Yes, I saw that as well.
Right. And so what we're seeing is this kind of like interstate agreements, because they're like, well, a state on its own, it's hard to push something, but once they unify, that's a lot of money. And so private companies and other folks who basically are the ones who have to follow the rules are much more likely to agree because of that kind of power.
Right.
And so that, so they're using their advocacy rather than just fighting Washington and the federal level.
Right.
They created their own answer.
So I love that. Okay. That
makes sense. That makes sense.
Now, and there are some states where that's really hard.
Right.
But there are also some states that may be controlled by a party that you might think was less friendly, but at the state level may still have an interest in some of those areas. Like, for all people's fussing, don't forget the ADA, the Rehab Act, many of the ADA and the Amendments Act both were passed under Republican Congresses, and they originally had Republican sponsors.
Yes.
So it's kind of one of those things going, it may be different than we think. So that would be my recommendation,
okay,
because we do have to learn new ways of doing things.
Okay.
So again, that think globally, act locally is important.
Yeah.
Because you can, I mean, it was a big shock to me years ago that you could just walk into the Capitol building and talk to your representative. And maybe today you need an
appointment, but they do listen. They do listen.
Yeah. But
local level, absolutely. Many of them will and do listen. And that's the other reason why I also tell people to start locally. If you start working with folks who are at that level, many of them want to move up to that federal level, and
that's
you
true.
Become that source of expertise that they will go to. When I was a lobbyist for the American Psychological Association, I had spent forever trying to get this one California senator just to sign on to a bill about providing educational services to immigrant children with disabilities, right? It was providing some of those healthcare services. And I kept trying to get an appointment with her office and trying to get them to just sign on to the bill. I couldn't get any real responses. And I finally got an appointment, and I took one of their psychologists from her district with me, and I didn't think anything of it. And we're there sitting with the legislative aide, and he'd worked with these kids with disabilities, and he'd provided mental health support for trauma and things like that. And he was telling his story. And then we hear from the door, "Manny asks us, what are you doing here in Washington?"
Oh.
And it was the congresswoman, and she knew him from her district.
Oh, wow. You know?
And she walks in, and he says, "Well, I'm here about this." And he says that, you know, this is a story, this is a bill. And she looks at her legislative staffer, and she goes, "Are we on that bill?" And the staffer's like, "No." She's like, "All right, we'll see to it."
Oh.
And then she goes, "Well, it was nice seeing you, Manny." And off she goes. And then the staffer's like, "Well, I don't think we have anything else to talk about." I have spent months, and all it took was this one expert who had worked on this issue, who
wow.
she knew and trusted from her district because he had talked to her, and she knew his knowledge in that area, and poof, that was it.
Wow.
Wow.
That's amazing. Wow. That's me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's before we move on, I've got to point out the elephant in the room is, did you meet or frequently meet or work with Obama?
I met with Obama when we did the big celebration for the Hate Crimes Prevention Act at the White House.
Awesome.
So it was the James Byrd Jr. and Matthew Shepard one.
I
did not get a picture of myself with Obama because I had run off to get a picture of myself with Cyndi Lauper.
Oh. Priorities. We all have to have priorities.
Yeah. Well, even though Obama is my personal humor, I get it. Cyndi Lauper does Trump Obama.
I'll be honest though. I worked during the Biden administration. So,
okay.
More recent, actually. And so one of the things about being the director of disability policy, meaning if it has anything to do with disability, it has to cross my desk. If there were any recommendations or suggestions, they had to come from me on that. It doesn't mean we didn't get into fights with other departments. So or other staff. And I'll be honest up front, one of the biggest folks that we had some polite arguments with were school safety folks.
Really?
If you think about accommodations for kids with disabilities, or the fact we know that school discipline happens to kids with disabilities more than anything else, they'll be like, they're just acting out. And I'm like, no, you haven't given them the accommodations they need, and they're frustrated.
Yes.
And they'll be like, no, they're not frustrated. They're dangerous. And the way the systems are set up, once you're pegged or thought of a certain way, there's not a way to actually take you off some of those lists, actually. It wasn't built into the system. So they'd be like, no, you have to track this to make sure they're safe. And I'm like, but you are working on some stereotypes and things. And so for some kids with autism or behaviors that aren't seen of as the norm, which can be any variety of things, then suddenly a lot of them were ending up in a lot more disciplinary issues. And I'm like, no, we need to ensure that there's protections there. And so there is that kind of push-pull. But in that position, it means I covered a lot of areas. So it's education, healthcare, telecommunications, it doesn't matter, everything, including, I think one of the things was, hey, we're working on the idea of the ethics around AI. Love the Office of Science and Technology Policy, because they started working on it and they actually sent a note to me going, you know, we're working on this. We thought, you know, maybe there's a disability angle. And I'm like, absolutely there is. Send that to you as well. Because the misconception that a lot of folks in policy have is that only the disability stuff is what the disability person should be working on. And I'm like, nope, I have an interest in everything because it all impacts us. And the biggest issue, you know, right now, AI is this magic word or magic letters.
Yes.
Or a phrase that everyone assumes and builds into everything else. But these language learning models, they're built off what is available.
Yes.
And if we think about what is the information that is available about folks with disabilities, about folks with blindness, right? They're either stereotypes, they're wildly inaccurate, they cover tragedies, they say we're incapable. And so what happens is these entire systems are built, and that are systems that are giving people advice and are making decisions and recommendations are absolutely wrong about blindness.
Correct.
And people
We just ran into that at AfterSight. Is we were given a book. I'm not going to say the title or anything on here, but it was about somebody and their white cane. And it's supposed to be a children/young adult book. And it was given to us and said, you know, basically said, you guys can do with it whatever you want. If you need, you know, if you want to sell them, make money for the, because we're a 501c3, or if you want to put it in audio edition so that it's accessible to everybody. So we decide, well, that would be our first step, is to put it in audio edition. Of course, I haven't read it because it's a book. It's just in print. And so I gave it to the staff, and I still haven't heard it yet, but I know we're working on it. But even the staff who are not blind said, I don't know if we should put this out there, because some of the language is just derogatory. And I'm sure the people that wrote the book did not have that intent, right? Or at least I want to believe that. But I agree with AI. It is scary because, I use it for work. But the first time I put in, I was just, you know, putting together an event. It was going to be for blind hikers, and the stuff that it spit out was like, what? Where did this come from? But you're right. It's only as good as what was put in, right? And so I now it's you know, my particular algorithms are more correct. I still work on them every day, but it is scary that this whole platform for the world, right? It's not just the United States. Is inaccurate information is being dumped into it constantly. And how is that going to affect our future, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
And I think that's why I pushed hard for it has to have some sort of individual human oversight and a recognition that they're built on human made systems. And what's the old rule? Garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly.
Wow.
So I want
that. That would be like if AI came out in 1776 and we were still, all our information was coming from that primitive time of thinking.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. It really is. I mean, it's kind of, what is it? Wikipedia. That's what they say. It's only as good as the people putting the information in.
Lots of people.
Exactly. But when did you decide to become a filmmaker? Was that during you being an advocate and this policy making, or did you have the film bug even before then?
So I started with the writing bug before the film bug. And that was just an accident of I moved to Washington, D.C., and my wife actually had to stay behind to finish her college degree in Missouri. And so I'm here for a year and I'm like, well, I'm by myself and I've got nothing to do. So I'm like, I signed up for the local fencing club. There was one at NIH at the time. And I signed up for a writing group.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm like, oh, this will be something fun I could do. Why not?
Yeah exactly.
And so started doing things like that just for fun. And I'm a huge science fiction and fantasy bug. So I love reading those things. And so it became fun to try and write those. And over time, I think I've become a big proponent because my entire career has been built on the idea of policy, right? All the way back to let's make better rules. Let's make better regulations. But there's only so much you can do, right, with a rule because it's still up to people to implement it and to do that. And it has to do with how people feel, how people believe, and what people know. And there was an old study done way, way back in the 80s. And it was like the number one way to minimize stigma against people with disabilities and to minimize discrimination is for them to spend time with people with disabilities.
Yes.
Like, well, yeah, of course.
Yes.
But the second most effective means was to have meaningful media and actually portrayed disability in a way that was accurate and authentic, and positive.
Yes.
And that actually was the second best way to reduce stigma. It also, if you think about it, has a broader way of amplifying it, right? Books and movies really can change people's perception. Yes. And so I started thinking about stuff in this dual way. One is through policy. The second was, what can I do on that creative side, which I was having a lot of fun with, which was kind of the books and eventually film, but the idea was books and the Labyrinth Archivist. One day I will come up with a better name for that. Was just, it's a murder mystery set in a fantasy setting. And the main character is a blind woman. That's it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have a murder story. I wanted to have the person who's the amateur detective be somebody who's blind. Awesome. No superpowers, no fancy stuff, just someone who pays attention. That's it.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun and I had fun writing it. And I'd sent it to a small press publisher, the first chapter to, and they were like, okay, that sounds interesting. Send me the first chapter or two. When I'd sent them the idea and they read the chapter, okay, you know, this is really good. We'll send a contract,
finish the book.
And
audio format?
I do not think it is. It is in Kindle, so it is available through that.
Right.
That's good. Not have it in audio. It's just the cost is a little high. Because I love my publisher. They're anti-AI. They don't want to do it. They want to do it with real voices. And that's just a little expensive.
Okay.
But it is available. And like I said, it was a fun time just being able to do that. And then the film stuff started out because I had this great story that I'd heard about disabled soldiers during the Civil War.
Yes.
You know, we all have heard that story, right? The whole, you know, thousands were killed and you know, even more were injured and had permanent disabilities. Nobody ever asked what happened to those disabled folks afterwards.
I know.
It's like, oh, you're disabled. And then they disappear from the history books. And I'm like,
yeah,
but they didn't.
No.
And they didn't go home either. There was such a need for manpower. There's such a need for manpower that they actually kept these folks in uniform. They found jobs for them to do. And in one case, they actually helped hold off Confederate soldiers and save the Union. Wow. Which is a fantastic story.
Yes.
But nobody wants to read another Civil War book. Even I didn't want to read another Civil War book.
I wouldn't say nobody, because most of
I love reading about the Civil War. and I found your film and the at least the story part around it absolutely mind blowing.
Yeah, exactly.
It was incredible.
And so that's the reason it became a film is because under the assumption that nobody would want to read it. And that's simply how that started. And then I realized this is fun. I'm enjoying this. And there's the response from people to that film was how many folks were like, I didn't know that. And it's the idea that how many of us within the disability community do not have a good understanding of our own history, right? Yeah. We get Helen Keller, FDR, and Stevie Wonder. We get the Holy Trinity, and that's it, right?
Yep,
and the fact is, there are so many other folks who were, like you said earlier, they're badasses, and they actually contributed to shaping this entire country. Like, we have a place in the history. So, you know, just like we have a place now as contributing, you know, valid, vibrant members of society. And we have that in the future too. And
Absolutely.
This was a way to show that to a broader audience in a way that was fun and exciting and dynamic versus, you know, the older tragedy or overcoming stories. They were just kind of like, nah, these people are really cool. That's the element. And I feel like the series was relatively successful at that insofar as we had disabled writers, disabled producers, disabled directors who built the films. And to make sure we were doing it right, we actually got an evaluator afterwards who ran surveys and evaluations. And I was just looking at it last week. And one of the things that I loved hearing from her, she said, looking at the returns and surveys, she goes, it doesn't hit the inspiration porn button because all the people who were watching it, including and especially the non-disabled people, didn't talk about how inspirational it was or how amazing. They were more caught up in why didn't I know about these people? This is really neat. And so it had kind of skipped the disability part and gone to, wow, that's neat. I want to be like that. And that's
that shows you really did hit the core of it, right? Because like I've seen, I'm sure you know Joe Strache.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked with Joe a lot about that and about it's you don't want it to be a movie about blind people, right? You just want it to be, or like even a book, right? You don't, you know, I have a lot of I've talked with a lot of authors that wrote stories where there's a blind character in it, and it's like they don't want their book to be, oh, it's the book about the blind girl. Right, you don't want it like that. And so it seems like you really did hit that core is this isn't like, oh, that's so inspiring, you know, or that's so amazing. This is a really awesome story and I can't believe I didn't know about it. Like that, it seems like you really hit that home with what you're doing. So what is next? Like, you know, I know your mom, congratulations. And, but like, what's next for you, Day?
Ooh, well, I would absolutely love to see a season 2 of Renegades, about amazing folks with disabilities who you've never heard of.
Yeah.
But probably should know. And you know, we are working as best we can to find funding for that. I think it's like for many folks right now, it's really tough because of we were almost entirely supported through the PBS system.
Right. So, exactly.
And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So they not only got Sesame Street, they got us too.
Exactly.
And so right now it's trying to find a way to do that. Like we already have a large, there's so many disabled filmmakers who are like, yes, we're ready. We want to help make this. We want to make it happen. I'm like, absolutely, let's do it. So there is that. Two, I really would like to get back to my blind detective. I had so much fun writing her. Hopefully she's a little less of a jerk about a few things in this next. it's for many of us blind folks, after a while you get that little chip on your shoulder. I can do this just fine by myself. And so I took that on her and I just turn that up to 11 to where I'm like, oh no, we want a flaw. There's a flaw for you. And kind of work on that. And so I'd really, really like to expand on that world and that character. And then maybe see what I can do with some younger stuff. And of course, having a 2-year-old also keeps me pretty busy.
Yeah.
So.
So on the blind detective is just blowing me out of the water here. Is before I ask the next question, is so you have one blind detective book out.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the name?
That is The Labyrinth's Archivist.
Okay. Yes. My disability is I'm very old and it's starting to show. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the other is Bob Ali and the Clockwork Gin. While it does have some character with disabilities, it does not have a blind character. So,
awesome.
No, a blind detective just makes absolute sense. because as you develop, it's like if I lose something, I go to Penn because she'll find it before I do. That's exciting. But since we're getting close to the end, you've got to share your White House guide dog story.
So my guide at the time was Gamma, unfortunately, who passed not too long ago from cancer. Amongst friends, we used to joke she's the most unprofessional guide dog.
I had one of those.
Yeah, very, very social, very extroverted.
Yeah,
I am not. So sometimes it's great to have a dog that is an exceptional worker. I will say that. In the middle of any city, you go somewhere once, she had the route down, which was fabulous for me. So it's like, I don't mind an extrovert because the working style was great. I also think because of our time there, she was the first regular working guide dog at the White House. Or at least I haven't come up with one that came before us. This was before I was working there, and we had been invited to, and I can't remember, it was an ADA anniversary event.
Mm-hmm.
It was a warm day and like we'd had water and she'd had her snack earlier and we're there. And, I think it had just about closed out and there was the post networking session and you hear that horrible noise. And I'm sure my face turned white and I'm trying to like grab the dog and head for the nearest door outside. We did not make it, and she threw up. She missed the shoes of the disability engagement office person's shoes by inches.
Oh no!
And I'm standing there like, great barf with from the dog in the White House. Looking for towels in the bathroom, like, can I just clean this? I'm like, no, we'll get somebody to do it. I'm like, okay. I think. Somewhere on the internet, there's a photo of her curled up under my desk afterwards. I'm like, this is my dog. She barfed at the White House today. And underneath, do you think we'll ever be invited back? And there's a lovely comment underneath from the head of public engagement at the time who said, she's a sweet dog. Yes, she'll be invited back.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I'm wondering, as an avid tourist, since that was a pretty historical event, if we go and tour the White House, will they show us where that happened?
Yeah, all you have to do is be right outside the theater where they have some of the the big talks, that theater area right outside there. That's where it was. So you can't miss it. And of course, at the time, you know, you're young and you're this advocate and you're like, yay, I want to, you want to be all professional. I'm in my suit. I look good. All of that. And then, and I'm like, well, there goes that. I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah, I think our guide dogs are really good about bringing us back down to earth.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. That is so funny. Well, Day, we always like our guests to kind of share something with our audience. What if you had a chance to go back on that day when you fell in the climbing accident, what would you whisper to your younger self? And then also, what would you shout to the world today?
The easiest one at the time would probably have been, it'll be okay. Aww. I think that's the biggest thing we tell each other, and maybe we need to tell each other, not just then, but now when we have those bad moments and things like that, it'll be okay, right? Just like everything else, we will figure it out.
Yeah.
And it may not be the answer we want or may not be the best way of things, but we will figure it out.
Yeah.
And that may have just also viewed the fact that most of the time my job, at least in my household, is I am the calm one. My wife is not. A 2-year-old certainly is not. So it is my job to tell everyone we'll be okay. So there's that. And if I had to shout anything to the world now, and maybe it is kind of that same message, is it'll be okay. It doesn't mean you give up. It doesn't mean we stop. You know, and it doesn't mean that things aren't hurting or aren't rough. It just means like we support each other. We make plans. We look for alternatives, and it'll be okay because we will work to try and make it that way, not just for ourselves, but for everyone else too.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we don't want you to sign off until you tell the world, how can they find out more about you, find out about your films, your books, keep track of you?
Oh, goodness. The easiest way to reach me is actually through my website, which desperately needs updating. So please don't judge me too harshly. And that's and it's just my name, actually, which is dayalmohammed.com. And honestly, if you even get close to the spelling of my name, I will show up in multiple places.
Yes, yes, you will.
So you can do that. The Labyrinth Archivist is available on Amazon. And I think you can also request it at your local Barnes & Noble. And it will show up there. And for the films, if you just Google Renegades PBS, you will find all 6 episodes. They are available with audio description, extended audio description, captioning, and ASL.
Wonderful. So
they are fully accessible.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Day, this has been such a treat. And I definitely want to keep track of you because what you're doing is so incredible. And our paths have crossed before, just not physically, with people we know. And I just really want to thank you for everything that you've done for our community and that you're continuing to do. It's very dear to my heart. So thank you.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. So it's
and today we did exactly what Day it's that we figured it out with this technology. And again, stay in touch. And everybody out there, I definitely want to thank AfterSight for continuing to support the Blind Chick. We would not be on air. And definitely not have the high quality without our fearless leaders like Jonathan Price, who is he's a magician, really.
Yeah.
And our podcast.
And Evan
Starnes.
Yeah, somebody go back and wake him up.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? We love Evan.
But without AfterSight, check us out, aftersight.org. You can see all of our programming there. And then remember this week to be kind to yourselves and find a way to be kind to somebody else. It's good for your soul.